For the first pair of talks that we gave for this retreat, the focus was on samadhi, the practices of concentration and states of concentration and a variety of things. And then yesterday Lee talked about not self, and he did so in the context of impermanence and unsatisfactoriness, and these are called the three characteristics, and these are the core insights of insight practice. And many people wonder, about the insights of insight practice. What are they? Many people have a variety of insights as they practice. And I like to think of that there's two sets of insights that are possible. And maybe it's unfortunate that I do this, because maybe it... there's one set of insight that where I use the... I spell with a lowercase I, the first letter, and the other one, which with a capital I, because it's the capital I is the one that is the important one in Buddhist practice, that are the ones that lead to liberation. The lowercase I can be quite important for people, and the difference between the two is the lowercase I are personal insights, something that which is might be true for many people, but not for everyone, and it's particularly true for you. So you see something about how you think, or what happened to you, the conditioning you had, maybe growing up, and how that plays out today. And you say, "Oh, I see. That's how it works. That's why I'm always so afraid." And then it's a big insight. Maybe it's a big aha. Maybe extremely important for our lives. And the capital I insight is insight into things which are universal, that is true for all human beings equally. So the degree to which the inconstant nature of life, our experience, is shared by everyone, not all aspects of impermanence and change are the same for everyone, for sure. But the fact that there is a layer or an aspect of human experience where we all share a certain aspect of the inconstancy of life, the changing quality of life, from sometimes the very big issue, like of death, we will at some point share this with each other, and to all the kind of to various minute little things where if you're very, very, very attentive, and you hear a sound, you won't hear a constant sound, but you'll hear a lot of small little sounds repeating themselves, kind of vibrating on and off, kind of. Or you can do that with seeing sometimes. You kind of see the pixels of things sometimes. And my teacher in Burma liked to give the analogy of a line of ants walking across the floor. And from a distance, it looks like a continuous, one solid line. But when you get really close, you see that there's a little gap between each ant. And so it's not really a line. The line is an illusion. The other example he loved doing was that of holding a fire wand, stick with a fire on, and making a big circle fast, over and over again. And if it goes fast enough, what you see is you see one full circle. But in fact, the flame's only in one place at a time. But the eyes usually are not quick enough to, we kind of blend it all together in the eye. So there's a way in which our sense experience, with our direct contact, direct experience of life, we can see it being inconstant and constantly moving and changing if we're very attentive to it. And that is something that is shared with everyone. Not that we all see it all the time, but that's the way the senses operate. And so if you're very attentive, that's how you'll see it. So that's considered to be universal. The unsatisfactoriness of experience is a very particular idea. Some things are very satisfying. Some things are obviously unsatisfying. But the degree to which we're trying to put all our eggs into one basket, or one, like really depending on something, is always and forever going to be there to provide us with satisfaction, that's kind of a dead end, or that's not really going to work. Sooner or later, it'll go away, we'll go away, things will shift and change. And if we, our kind of life depends on that satisfying thing being there, then our life is on a foundation which is a little bit insecure. If we're lucky, that satisfying thing lasts for our lifetime. If we're not lucky, it doesn't last. And many things that people unconsciously depend on and expect to be there forever begin to shift and change. And the symbolic one that I saw in Burma, symbolic for me, representative for me, was waking up one morning, and I was informed that all the paper currencies above a certain amount of money, and a certain amount of money was more than a dollar or something, because was just declared invalid. And I never it occurred to me that. I mean, I just like, you know, in God we trust, and we can count on that. I mean, it's not going to change. I mean, that's like inviolable. That, you know, currency is currency. It's, you know, you can't just wake up in the morning and it's gone. And then, you know, it's probably not even worth. Burmese currency probably wasn't even worth as much as toilet paper, given the quality of it. So the idea that things, you know, things that we count on can change so quickly makes it this idea that it's not inherently or lastingly or enduringly satisfying. So be careful what you how much you invest in all kinds of things. So that kind of wisdom idea, that principle, is kind of something shared by all human beings, because of how things are fleeting and changing and unpredictable what will happen. And then this idea of not-self, there's something about that teaching, something about that insight, which is equally true for everyone. And it's not there's aspects which is true for particular people, and some things which are true for all of us. And the practice leads us to see this universal aspect of how, and there's a whole, I think it's a wide range of ways we can see it, some of them that Lee talked nicely about yesterday. So these are the insights. So there's the concentration practices, and there's the insight practices. So this points to a distinction, which I think is very important to understand, is that there's a difference between cultivation, what we cultivate in our practice, and the insights we have. Turns out we don't cultivate the insight into impermanence. We don't cultivate the insight into unsatisfactoriness or dukkha. We don't cultivate the insight into not-self. We cultivate the conditions that allow us to have those insights. And when the conditions are in place, then those insights will come. Sometimes people say they come on their own. I like to think of them sometimes as revelation. I like the word revelation because, and in my mind at least, the word revelation means it's a little bit of a surprise. Like, it's not like you're doing, like, ah, look, there it is. And so it's not like we have to convince ourselves that everything's impermanent. And this was something that I a little bit struggled with when I was in practicing in Thailand and Burma. The teachers there gave talks on the three characteristics. I probably shouldn't say ad nauseum, so I won't. But they did it a lot. But it wasn't just that they were doing it a lot. it was so repetitive what they said. You know, they all had, you know, they must have all read the same book. And it was like, you know, it's like it's the same thing over and over again. It was so dogmatic, like this is how it is, this is the truth, this is, you know. And it kind of like, when I heard it, it was kind of like, I better believe this. Like this is like the core creed of the religion. And, you know, and I just couldn't quite get myself to believe it. It just like, really? It didn't quite make sense to me, the way it was taught and the way that they expected me to kind of take it in. So the good thing about that was that I kind of then spent time reflecting, thinking, grappling with this teaching that that teachers can kind of just kind of, like me, will just kind of glibly, you know, talk about as if it's obvious or something. So it's good to grapple with these things. And and I think that sometimes these teachings on the three characteristics are brilliant teachings, and there some people are really benefit from hearing them the first time. They go, wow, now it all makes sense. And other people find it certainly perplexing, and some people find it actually, I don't know if harmful is the right word, but discouraging to do it. You know, if someone who has grown up with a life of constant change and, you know, no stability, they grew up in a war zone and constantly moving and, you know, nothing seemed stable and no one was stable in their lives. And that's what the conditioning they grew up in. And you tell them that everything's impermanent, and it might just kind of be, you know, just make it even more discouraging, like there's no hope. Or you tell someone who has had a tremendous amount of suffering in their life, just all kinds of challenges that just seem unremitting, and just, you know, and you tell them, oh, you know, life is suffering. You know, that, again, wow, that's going to give up all hope for them. No hope then. You know, it's just like, you know, just why make an effort then? And then someone who has their sense of identity has been stripped from them, and their role in life, and their sense of self is, you know, there's been so much struggle and difficulty around it for whatever reason, that there's no confidence in themselves, and their own efficacy, and their place in life, and you say there's no self, or, you know, that, you know, it could, again, it could just be, either it could be, you know, very discouraging to hear this Buddhist teaching. It's like, or confusing, or kind of debilitating, actually, to hear it all. What am I supposed to, you know, how am I supposed to be? Or they could come to Buddhism and say, I'm finally home. I get to be nobody. Isn't that great? I don't have to try to create or have any sense of self, or I don't have to pay attention to myself or really know what's going on. There's not a few people who came back from Asia. Lee told me about this yesterday, about the famous early English Buddhist man. But there were people who came back from Asia practicing there and heard these teachings of not-self. And so they said, well, if that's true, then I'll stop using the personal pronoun. And so instead of saying, you know, I'm angry, they say, I'm like, there's a lot of heat and energy here. But how are you feeling? Oh, the heat is spreading this way and that way, and there's a lot of pus and stuff, you know. But it's kind of hard to find out, is anybody there, or what's really going on? Because, you know, they're kind of avoiding any kind of personal something, because there's supposed to be no self, right? That this is what people, some people think. So these three insights, the three characteristics, are amazing. Can be amazingly powerful and wonderful to go through them. And they're considered doors that you step through to profound possibilities of liberation. But they are, and so I think, see them more as insights. There's something we can see, but they don't have to be something we believe. There's, you know, I don't think there's any need to believe them. Sometimes it's useful to kind of, you know, to kind of believe that things will change. So when you go out and get your car and the tire's flat, yep, impermanence. you know, so you're not surprised. But what we do in practice is we cultivate the opposite of the three characteristics. It's cultivating the opposite of them that creates the conditions that helps us to see them, both to see them in a good way, but also see them in a way that where we can kind of integrate them or benefit from having those insights. So the opposite of seeing impermanence or inconstancy is to have stability, steadiness. And so part of the role of Buddhist practice and many of its forms, including meditation, is to cultivate a sense of deep, abiding sense of stability, steadiness in the mind, in the heart, in the body. And that's part of the role of samadhi practice, is to be able to get calm, stable, steady, so that the mind is not distracted, jumping around, it's not agitated. And certainly you can't count on the mind staying stable and steady forever, but you can get it into a calmer, steady, stable place. And developing strong samadhi, the mind gets stiller and stiller and stiller, more and more stable, more settled, more still, whatever the word you like, but I like the word stability. And so we cultivate that stability through mindfulness practices that help us to see how we're instable, how the mind is jumping around and how we react to things and how we get to latch onto things. And we learned a lot of self-learning, a lot of the insights in a small eye that go on. We start learning how the mind works. And as we see it more and more clearly, we tend not to be so pulled into the world of agitating activities of the mind. And then we slowly begin willing to kind of let go, you know, let go of some of those things and let the mind settle down and become calmer. And one of the, at least for me, one of the very nice images of a calm, settled mind is a mind that's surface is like, it's like the surface of a calm lake. It's completely peaceful. And I've had so many times in my life sitting in a mountain, next to the mountain lake and looking out early in the morning, and it's so still and peaceful that I wouldn't mind my mind being like that. So, you know, to me it's very comforting. And so the concentration practices support that and help that. The opposite of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness or suffering or stress, is I think of it as well-being. And there's a whole class of states that I include within the word well-being. I like the word well-being because I think of it as relatively vague. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's something very general, and it could be very mild, it could be... So I use the word hoping that everyone can kind of find something in there. Whereas if I use the word joy, you know, that's more maybe situational or kind of specialized. But well-being meant to be a broad word that includes things like joy and happiness and contentment, ease, delight, gladness, you know, a whole bunch of things, but well-being. I also like the word well-being because, at least in my vocabulary as I use it for me, I feel it is very embodied. I feel like it's a sense of well-being is something I feel. When I feel well-being, I feel it in my body. And this idea of being grounded in the body and feeling something really feels good there and nourishing, I think is really a nice thing. So we cultivate well-being. And there's many things that cultivate that sense of well-being. Some of the same things that cultivate stability also cultivate well-being. But it's not just meditation practice. There's practices of generosity. Part of the reason to practice generosity is to have something that you do that makes you happy when you think about having done it. Feel good about yourself. Practice ethical integrity, not just so you can be good, you know, or, you know, because you're supposed to, but do it in such a way that it makes you feel good and feel kind of happy or joyful that you do this. It's nice. The you know, and cultivate the Brahma-viharas, compassion and loving kindness, not just because, you know, you've heard it's a good idea, but because that also can generate a sense of well-being. The goal, like, you know, it's very, I think it's fantastic that you know, when we cultivate compassion, or when compassion arises, and we've kind of learned ourselves well enough that we know, understand the agitating forces of the mind, we know the tendencies of the mind to cling and resist and get afraid or identify with things, and we know those things well enough, we don't do them. And so the compassion can exist there without any resistance, without any despair, discouragement, without any fear. And even when there's some big suffering in the world that our compassion arises with, and we meet it with compassion, with genuine compassion, there is something about that compassion which has well-being in it, or is nourishing, or has a rightness to it. It's a good thing. If you Dalai Lama said, if you want to be happy, be compassionate. And then the samadhi practices, as we've talked about, are practices that cultivate well-being. And it's one of the wonderful things that it's possible, and kind of amazing thing, that you can sit quietly and get a little bit focused and have some samadhi, and you can feel a sense of well-being that does not depend on winning the California lottery. Doesn't depend on getting a raise or something in the world, being just the right way, having the right housing arrangements or the right bank account or the right this or this, you know, whatever. Doesn't depend on the things in the world. And that provides a lot of confidence. When you really get a sense of that, that your well-being is not dependent on things in the world so much, that you have a sense, you have access to a sense of well-being that's very satisfying, that doesn't require something, the world to change or be different, or you can just sit and be quiet. And to really take that in is a tremendous lesson. It's not meant to be a disparagement or a rejection of all other forms of happiness and well-being from the world and things happening. But it does mean that we don't depend on that alone. If the only happiness we know is the happiness that comes from the world being just the right way, then, you know, of course we're going to be afraid the world changes, we're going to be holding on to things. I think naturally we'll cling then if our happiness is only dependent on the world. But if we know there's some other option, then we're not going to be so dependent on the world. We're not clinging as much or be so as upset when things go away in the world. And so the Buddha actually gave as a prescription more or less he said in one place where he kind of thought it was really hard to let go of some of the deep desires we have, sensual desires we have, unless people develop some modicum of concentration, samadhi, as an alternative sense of happiness or well-being that's better than the sensual desire thing. So rather than like Buddhists being party poopers, you know, like, you know, get over your sensual desire, let it go, have no sensual desire, you know, just, you should kind of walk around like cardboard and dull and, you know, restrained and, you know, no joy if you're a Buddhist. You know, rather, he said, for the Buddha, go for that thing which is even better. There's a better happiness, better joy. And if you experience it, then you're not going to depend on the sensual desire, sensual pleasures. And if you don't depend on it, then it's less likely to be attached to it, less likely to be, you know, consumed with thoughts about it. Doesn't mean you can't enjoy it, it's just your relationship to it begins to change. So this samadhi is, you know, the sense of well-being we're cultivating is very important. And then the opposite of not self, I'm just kind of making this up, so you can decide for yourself what you think the opposite is. But I like the word confidence a lot. That there's a strong sense of personal confidence, strong sense of personal efficacy, strong sense of personal integrity, strong sense of really, you know, we know ourselves well. We understand ourselves, and we have the ability to be honest and clear, and there's no not succumbing all the time to being defensive or feeling that we don't count, but to really kind of take our place in the world and stand on our own 2 feet and be there as if we're here, not asserting ourselves necessarily, not being conceited or arrogant, but not being the opposite either, but just we're here in a clear, confident, upright way. So cultivating, developing a sense of a strong sense of self, and modern psychologists would use it. In fact, someone who's become spiritually mature in ancient Buddhism, they use the term, it's kind of a title, probably an ancient Indian title, so you don't want to kind of now latch onto it as being, you know, some proof of some kind of Buddhist philosophy about the self, but the title of someone spiritually mature is that they're a great self, Maha-Atta, and that's what we called Gandhi. The word Mahatma means the same thing. It means that it's the same word. It's an ancient Indian title for great people, great self. So the idea of, you know, so the idea of not self doesn't mean we become self-effacing or that we don't count. But, you know, to have the sense of, you know, strong confidence. And that's also one of the functions of Buddhist practice, is to cultivate that through all the trainings that Buddhism offers, trainings in ethics, training in samadhi, trainings in wisdom. We develop these things over time. And the jhana practices is a phenomenal way of developing a very strong sense of confidence and a sense of power even that comes with it. I don't think that Buddhist practice means that we need to be shy about feeling personally powerful, but we should, of course, be ethical about that, or, you know, not be caught or in the grip of it. So the practice cultivates these things and develops these things. It's a slow thing, it's not automatic. And it can develop for decades as we keep practicing and learning and going. And those cultivating these states then set the stage for the mind to be able to have these insights, to look into our direct experience in a deep way. And so in a very calm, still, steady mind, has a chance to see how things are, the way in which things are constantly moving and changing, the way they're impermanence. Though the word impermanent is probably not a good translation for anicca. The word literally means inconstant. And the advantage of the word inconstant over impermanence is that impermanence means, some people hear that in English and think, they think it means, it simply means everything will sooner or later go away, will disappear. Whereas inconstant means that it's there irregularly, comes and goes. So like the daylight is not impermanent in the sense that it's not going to be there sometime. I guess someday it won't be here maybe, but the daylight for us in our experience is inconstant. It comes for a while, and then it goes away at night, and it comes back the next day. So it's not that kind of impermanence. So when the mind is very still, very quiet, so still and stable, and so confident, with a sense of well-being, we're not reaching out for the future, not reaching out for the past, not reaching out for concepts and ideas, not so concerned with, you know, the stories of our life and the stories of the present moment, and thinking things, all this. And so then slowly then we get closer and closer to the immediacy of what's actually being experienced here and now in the moment. And it becomes, can be kind of pristine sometimes, the feeling of the immediacy of this moment here. The mind is still and quiet, and we're not caught up in, you know, all the, you know, fascinating things the mind can do. And then when we're in that moment-to-moment experience, then we start getting a sense that things are constantly inconstant. They're coming and going. Sounds come and go, sensations come and go, thoughts come and go, feelings come and go, sensations come and go. Emotions have a way of, and they come and go. There's an amazing study where they say that left to themselves, no emotion will last more than 90 seconds. I mean, it's, first time I read that, I said, what? not me. I have, you know, serious emotions. They last more than 90 seconds. And the idea is that emotions last longer, of course, sometimes, you know, for a very, very long time, because they're being renewed all the time, every 90 seconds. By our stories, the way we react, and all kinds of things. But to see, but in Buddhism, the emotions, the direct experience of emotion, has a certain kind of inconstancy that's even faster than 90, you know, once every 90 seconds. And so it's a different world that we enter into when our mind is really still and quiet. It's a world that's so different than how we usually orient ourselves and find our way in the world that for some people it's disorienting, even frightening to do that because it's so different. You know, what we depended on, how to find our way in the world, how to be safe in the world, is not really there if we're just in that very simple, pristine moment-to-moment experience. And so it helps a lot if we have a lot of stability to feel that. The stability kind of is a container or a support for it. It helps if we have a sense of well-being. It helps if we have this confidence and sense of efficacy that, you know, we're capable of finding our way. And then it can feel a lot easier to enter into this world of change and impermanence. Sometimes we see, as Lee said, you know, how unsatisfactory things are, and the particular way Buddhists like to talk about it, or the kind of inherent dukkha quality of so much that goes on. And but if you've cultivated this stable, strong sense of well-being, even if it's not always there, it's kind of like we've been conditioned by it, we've been washed over by it, we've been kind of informed by it, our cells have kind of taken it in long enough, then when we see the unsatisfactory aspect of experience, see some of the challenging aspects that can happen when we see that everything's constantly changing, it's kind of held by that well-being. It was very clear to me when I was in Burma practicing this practice there. There was a time where I became acutely aware of my thoughts and the coming and going of my thoughts. And then at some point I became aware of this, you know, not just what I was thinking about, but the experience of thinking. What it was felt like in my physiology and brain to actually have these thoughts. And I was very sensitive, and I thought, actually, the thoughts I'm having, there's a kind of stress or tension. There's a kind of dukkha in them. And I thought, well, there's a lot more dukkha here than I ever realized. Because some of my thoughts I thought were pretty good. Yeah, I enjoy having the thoughts, the stories. But that's underneath the story, then how I got caught by the pleasant story, there was something about it which didn't feel quite so right. And then it just happened. I was kind of stunned, and I kind of realized that the amount of suffering in the world was so much greater than I ever realized. If we're that sensitive, And I was just like blown away, like all the suffering in the world, you know, it was pretty powerful for me. But what was kind of the, what was happening for me at the same time, I was just filled with joy. Not because of that, prior to that. That's what the state I was in when I had that insight, that understanding. So it's kind of like a little odd, right, to kind of be blown away, stunned by the amount of suffering in the world. I mean, it really had a big impact on me, changed me. And I'm partly here teaching because of that one, that experience. So it's a big, big impact on me. But as I had it, I was having it in this container of well-being. So I wasn't blown over, I wasn't crushed by it. I had something, I had a way of holding it that where it wasn't the whole story. Does that make sense? Okay. And then we see, you know, the ways in which of not self, the how our experience is not self. And we have a sense of well-being, we have a sense of stability, we have a sense of confidence that it's okay. It's like, you know, if you've had a particular role in life and you've identified with a role and everyone likes you because of your role, and then, or whatever, you get you're safe because you have your role, and then suddenly your role disappears, and then, you know, I mean, like some people, there's stories of people who die soon after they retire, because it's so challenging not to have that role. But then, you know, to have this stability, confidence, well-being that doesn't depend on a role, doesn't depend on it. The role is not me. That's okay with me. I have something better going on. I don't have to identify with these things as being me because there's something better going on. And then you say, well, this better thing, that's me. But that's just more, that's just, ooh, ouch. If you're quiet and still, you feel how you lose some of the ease, some of the peace, some of the well-being, some of the openness, as soon as you latch on to the openness and the peace. It's like you finally manage to open your hand. You've been clutching your fist for decades. And finally, you know, it took a long time, first one finger, and then a decade later the second finger. You know, it took a while, it's a lot of work. And it felt so good. Oh, this is the best. This is nirvana. This is good. I gotta have it. I have it. Now I have it, right? You don't have it anymore. It's gone. So there's something very significant about recognizing that we have these wonderful states, these wonderful ways of being, this freedom. But to identify with it, to get attached to it, is the very thing that kind of we lose it in the process. So we don't have to hold on to it. We don't have to take it as myself, because we, you know, we have another thing going on. And so to be able to enter into the world of seeing or the world of experience, you know, and it's to see it really deeply, to see into the world of the three characteristics, it's mostly something we do in deep meditation. You don't have to be worried that after, you know, you're going to leave meditation, it's going to stay with you forever now. And as Lee said very nicely this morning, that you know, nothing's really changed, except that you see more clearly, and you've cut through a certain kind of conceptual overlay that we laid on top of reality. And we can pick up those concepts again if they're useful when we come out of this. And so this willingness then to relax and settle and just be here and enter into the world or the experience of impermanence, to see it deeply. And the function of going it deeply is to not for its own sake. It isn't like the reason we do this is only so we can see impermanence, only so we can see unsatisfactoriness, only so we can see not self. But they're rather their insights or perspectives that for many people or this is what the Buddhist tradition is offering, they're perspectives that are very, very helpful for the fist relaxing, for letting go, for not clinging or holding or resisting so much. And some of the deepest places of holding and clinging within us, it's hard to see. It's hard even to know that it's there. And so we get very quiet and still, concentrated, and confident, have a sense of well-being, so that the mind can begin looking at the roots, look at the underlying foundation of clinging that kind of builds the foundation for the edifice of clinging that comes out of it. And so to see some of the deeper places. And so then to kind of see it and then to begin trusting or relaxing or being willing to let go or to see clearly it doesn't make any sense to cling. To see there's nothing there to cling to. So when people see impermanence deeply, sometimes they realize how much they've always been holding on. The tradition calls it a sign, but maybe in our English we can call it a concept, that rather than relating to a thing, we relate to the concept of a thing, the idea of it. And when we enter into the world deeply and be able to relax the mind enough so that the conceptual overlay stops, then there's a and the mind really feels or sees that there's no sign there, there's no concept there, then the holding on to concepts has a chance to relax. There's a door of that related to dukkha, unsatisfactoriness or suffering. And that is that as we go into this world clearly and clearly and clearly, then the desire for satisfaction, the wish for it, the wanting of it, looking for it, searching for it, the quest for it, there's something about this deep practice where we see, oh, there's nothing here. It feels so good. It feels so quiet. It feels so still. There's nothing here to wish for. And so for some people it's the incessant, ongoing desire, wanting this and wanting that and not wanting this. If there's enough trust in the place where there's nothing to wish for, the wishing, the wanting relaxes. And then the door of connected to not self is if you're having a self, we're kind of creating something. We call it the illusion of self. We're creating something that is enduring, that's permanent, that's kind of always there. And Lee calls it the immortality project, maybe. It's very delicate, this thing, because as people get quiet, one of the things that they feel very intimate to, very personal, is who they are. And we have to be very sensitive and respectful of how people think of themselves and how they are. It's kind of a little bit sacred, how people feel about them. So the personal, even their personal identity is kind of a sacred thing. It's a careful thing to be sensitive to and aware of. But sometimes people go, when they go deeper in, their identity is no longer tied to I am X, but it simply becomes I am. And the sense of M-ness seems so profound, so deep, so kind of spiritual, so universal, so satisfying, just a sense of M-ness. But it turns out that in this practice, that if you settle in and keep practicing mindfulness and keep kind of letting go of, that even the sense of M-ness falls away, relaxes. And then there's no thing there. And that's sometimes, in Buddhism, is called emptiness. And in the state of emptiness, realize that there is nothing enduring. There's nothing to hang your hat on, nothing to claim as this is who I am. And then this very deep-seated tendency human beings have to hold on to self, to hold on to life, has a chance to relax. And I'm using this kind of choicefully, the idea, all these things relax, relax, relax. I'm not saying realize these things and die. You know, be done with all this, you know. We're still here. And the confidence, the well-being, the sense of stability is still available. But the extra ways in which we cling and hold on, grasp, is put down. The analogy that's sometimes used is, there's a little story from the Chinese Buddhism of a person who's climbing up the mountain with a big bag over his shoulder. And someone's coming down, and the climber says, how do I deal with my burden? What do I do? It's so heavy, it's so hard. And the person just says, drop it. So he drops it off his back. The story goes on a little bit more, but I don't know if that's, you'll take it as good news. But then he says, well, what do I do now? The person says, now you pick it up. So you don't want to pick up all the things you drop down. But there is part of practice is then knowing how what to pick up again. And the more you drop, the more you're able to kind of fully, completely let go, then you have much more choice and wisdom to know what to pick up, what ideas, what concepts to pick up again, hopefully without clinging to them. And we can participate in all kinds of ways of being, all kinds of identities, all kinds of roles, all kinds of activities. But our deepest sense of happiness and well-being is not dependent on doing all those things. We're not looking for freedom or ultimate happiness in those things that we pick up again. But we give ourselves over them fully if that's what's called for. If that's, you know. Because we know we've touched a place of freedom, a place of peace, a place of real satisfaction, a place of that's very nourishing or supportive, or, you know, I don't know quite what the right language is to describe it. Probably for each person it's experienced differently. The Buddhist tradition likes to call it the unconditioned or the unconstructed, unmade. And so it has this kind of a sense of deep, valuable place of well-being or freedom that's not dependent on anything that's conditioned or constructed or made in the world. And to realize that, then we can participate in the constructed world with greater ease and with greater even commitment, dedication to live in the world for the betterment of everyone and support people and try to make this a better world. And we can do it with greater stability, calm. We can do it with greater sense of well-being and joy. We can hopefully do it with without being caught up in self-identity issues about how we do and, you know, how it is for me and how I'm seen and all that. And with those three qualities, those insights, with those three these qualities of being that we have, I think that we have a much better chance of being effective in what we do and to support our world, support our fellow human beings, and make a difference from our freedom. So, we cultivate the opposite of the three characteristics And each of you maybe can, will have your own word for what idea, what the opposite is. And when those are cultivated, then in its own time, the three characteristics are seen clearly. And in the meantime, you don't have to believe the three characteristics are true, regardless of what all those teachers say. But it might be from time to time, if you don't really, provisionally, it can be a good idea to act, to behave as if it's true. So hopefully you can kind of find your way with it, but at some point it becomes your insight. It becomes your own, not something that is to be believed.